Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. For almost 15 years, the IBM Center for the Business of Government has sought to connect research to practice, sponsoring third-party research on a broad range of public management issues facing us today. As the U.S. economy continues along the path to recovery, lawmakers are searching for ways to cut spending and reduce the country's $17 trillion debt. DOD, which consumes the second largest portion of government revenue after entitlements, will likely see significant cuts in the coming years. Indeed, cuts are already being made. And at the same time, DOD must continue to support operations and modernize forces in order to support national security. In light of these budgetary constraints and evolving security challenges, DOD will need to gain every possible efficiency while reducing the temptation to buy defense on the cheap. To be successful, DOD must incentivize and partner with the private sector and find ways to emulate the private sector's overall accomplishment, improving performance while reducing costs. What acquisition challenges are facing the U.S. Department of Defense? What about prior attempts at DOD acquisition reform? And what actions can be taken to improve defense acquisition and the defense industrial base? Today, we'll explore these questions and much more with Dr. Jack Gansler and Bill Lucian from the University of Maryland's School of Public Policy and authors of the IBM Center report, 8 Actions to Improve Defense Acquisition. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Bill, welcome. Good to have you both.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Jack and Bill, there have been various efforts to improve DOD's acquisition performance. Would you highlight the key aspects of these prior attempts at DOD acquisition reform? And more particularly, what lessons have been learned from these initiatives?
Well, one that immediately occurs to me is the Packard Commission. This was at the time when we had these overpriced toilet seats and hammers and, you know, coffee pots and things like that. And we approached it by looking at it from an organizational structure because we didn't really have a single person in the Pentagon or in the whole Department of Defense responsible for acquisition up to that point. So we created an Undersecretary of Defense, and we also didn't have any one person responsible for all the requirements for the weapon systems, for the services, and so forth. So we created the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Those two positions then allowed us to make some structural changes, which I think is the right way to go about trying to do it, as contrasted to Congress's solution. Now, it's often good to tell some stories about, how did they react to it. Congress's solution to the overpriced toilet seats was to legislate a price not to exceed $220 each for a toilet seat and add 5,000 auditors to make sure. That adding 5,000 auditors really increased the cost significantly and the delays and so forth. It didn't solve the problem of acquisition because it actually raised the cost and slowed down the process.
And Jack, you used to be in that role, right?
I was the undersecretary at one point, yes.
Bill, did you have anything to add?
Yes. If you look at these initiatives, many of them cover and try to address the same problems. If you look at the Carlucci initiatives, he came out with a list of topics that were very much similar to what you might see in the Better Buying Power initiatives. And so one of the key problems is the cost of systems continues to grow consistently at about a 40% rate, and people don't necessarily implement the good ideas. And so one of the key issues, I think, is the organizational inertia and organizational culture and how difficult it is to change that. And so all of these initiatives had excellent ideas in general, but they're not always well implemented.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. So your report also points out that the DOD acquisition or basically it's the budget itself, the funding for DOD, has been cyclical historically. And I want to transition to what are some of the fiscal or global threat challenges facing DOD today that will influence how they procure?
Well, one of the most obvious things is it's uncertain. And therefore, the preparation for a wide variety of future potential events, it has to increase your cost, because you got, how do you handle everything from terrorism to cybersecurity to tank-on-tank engagements and so forth? And that uncertainty represents a challenge when the budgets are declining. And that's been a traditional problem. And in fact, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, when he was there, Mike Mullen, said the number one national security problem is the debt. Mm-hmm. Because if we can't handle it all, how do we get prepared for it? And our strategy for the last like 50 years has been technological superiority. That's been our national security strategy. Well, then that means you have to continue to invest in research. And one of the first things that always goes when the budget declines, the first three things actually are travel, training, and research. So the training and research are kind of foolish things to cut. On the other hand, because especially with the uncertainty, you want to be able to respond rapidly, and that's what training is for, readiness. And research is so that you can stay ahead technologically. And we're losing our lead in that. And technology has now become globalized so that everybody has technology. It's hard to maintain technological leadership unless you invest in it.
Bill, did you have any?
Well, when you look at the budget, you can see that the average budget over the last 70 years for DoD has been about $480 billion. And so we're still well above that level. But at the same time, you have increasing O&M costs and increasing healthcare costs, increasing support costs. So there's a tremendous squeeze on what's left in the budget to allow for modernization. And that's, I believe, a significant threat.
One of the things that I could add to that is that people believe that this 18-year cycle that we see in the defense budget is somehow a law of nature. It's not. It's exogenously driven. Every time there's an external event like 9/11 or Pearl Harbor or North Korea, you know, any of those events, that's what drives the budget. It's not just a law of nature that follows every 18 years. You build it up and it comes down and goes up and comes down. I think it's important to recognize that this uncertainty of the strategic environment is also affecting the uncertainty in the budget environment.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a very good point. And I wanted to talk about transitioning a little bit to some of the initiatives the current administration has been pursuing around DoD acquisition reform or cutting costs. And one of them, one of the series is insourcing, this term called insourcing. And I was hoping you gentlemen would help me understand what is meant by this term, insourcing, and what are the implications of pursuing such an initiative vis-a-vis the DoD?
Well, first of all, the most obvious thing is that it's political. It's politically driven, and particularly by the government union, so that when you have a situation where you used to gain enormous benefit by competing public against private, now you don't, because when you decide to insource it, it's sole source. Mm-hmm. And the example that's easiest to point out there is maintenance. The Congressional Budget Office did a comparison of maintenance in-house by government workers, in other words, versus competitively done in the private sector. They said it was 90% more expensive to do it sole source in the government than to compete it. You could allow the government, of course, to compete in public-private competitions, but Congress has outlawed that also. And so right now the law says 50% of all maintenance work shall be done sole source by the government. And that's been driven by primarily something called the Depot Caucus. It's the largest caucus on Capitol Hill, 135 members, for the maintenance work in the depots. And it's because many of them have like 20,000 voters in their district, and you can't find where you can put a maintenance depot that isn't in a congressional district. So it's mandated by Congress that they will do in-house that much more work. And there's no argument, at least for sole sourcing, public or private, that says you've eliminated competition now. And it's certainly not an inherently governmental function, which we can come to later. Wrench-turning is clearly – I read the Constitution carefully. Wrench-turning is not in there as an inherently governmental function.
And the other thing about this is if you're going to insource – and I don't want to jump ahead – but you're going to need that competency inside the government. I mean if you insource something and you can't do it, you don't have the capability – it becomes largely a political act, really. I mean, yeah. Bill, do you have anything to add?
Well, I think there was a belief that insourcing would save money.
Okay.
And I think that came from comparing, if you look at some of the articles and the advocates, they compared salaries of the government employees with the full burden cost of contractors. So you had stories like a guard cost the government, say, $150,000, but a Marine private only cost $20,000 a year. And that was the comparison. And that's a false comparison because it's not the full burden cost to the government for that private. So you had this sense that insourcing would save money, and that proved to be false. Contractors and government personnel, when you look at the full burden cost, come out to be about the same cost to the government.
It depends on the function,
yeah.
And as you pointed out, whether or not they have the skills and knowledge. But the example that Bill just used of guards, the Congressional Budget Office also did comparison of public versus private there. And again, the county, the overhead difference, because you get the retirement pay and the medical long-term coverage and the facilities and all that, which private sector has to include in their costs. And again, it was 90% more expensive to do it in-house with the guards than it was to have it private.
You don't hear about this enough.
No.
That's what's problematic.
Well, that's an important point.
Yeah.
That you know, good news is no news. And therefore, you don't hear about the positive side. What you see in the paper is waste, fraud, and abuse. It's, in fact, in a lot of the articles, treat that as one word. So the fact that fraud is different than waste, one is illegal, one is just dumb, you know. And we found in the Packard Commission, we did a public survey, most of the public, by reading those articles, thinks that the industry is overcharging and making excessive profits. Mm-hmm. What they, again, aren't aware of is the fact that the profit made by the defense industry is actually less than a regulated industry.
I mean, it's important distinctions between those terms, fraud, waste, and abuse, and what they mean. And there was another initiative in spring 2010 released by the DEPSEC at DOD, and it was the Better Buying Power Initiative. Could you tell us a little bit about that initiative, and how has it evolved since its inception?
Well, one of the things that is essentially wrong in it was it said all services will be recompeted every 3 years. Mm-hmm. That's a total disincentive to a service company. Instead, what it should have said is you'll be rewarded with a follow-on if you reduce the cost and improve the performance. That's an incentive to get higher performance at lower cost. And that's been dropped in the follow-on Better Buying Power 2.0, yeah. But I think that's the kind of thing that you just don't want to incentivize backwards, you know.
Well, I think that was a change in how the initiative evolved.
Okay.
The first one was more prescriptive. It said always do this or always use fixed price contracts. And the second one tried to be a lot more nuanced and said use the appropriate contract structure, use the appropriate kind of competition.
Was that because folks complained? I mean, could you give us some – is it because there's lessons learned and they influenced
them?
Well,
I think there was a lot of pushback
from
the industry, particularly like with the lowest price technically acceptable.
What are the unintended consequences of focusing on – and I think, Jack, you got to this a little bit with the disincentives. But when you focus on reducing costs, you gentlemen point out in your report that it leads to unintended consequences. What are they?
Well, if you end up focusing on low cost and forget about high performance and high reliability, you get cheap junk.
Yeah.
And that's not what we need. What we need is high performance at low cost. And to get that, you need incentives. And the way you can get incentives, one of them is, of course, through competition. Another is by rewarding, if you have a sole source supplier, that they can either get a higher profit if they do lower cost, because profit's only a small percentage. It's only 5% of the total cost. If you can figure out how to reduce the total cost, you could give them 6% profit on a smaller number. Okay, so that's one way you can do it. Another way you can do it is by incentivizing them through follow-on business. If they do a good job, they'll get the follow-on. If they don't get higher performance at lower cost, throw it open to competition. That's essentially the threat of competition. But it works.
And compliance is an issue. If everything becomes a compliance game, it's a disincentive, correct? I mean,
that's a telling you how to do it.
Yeah.
Instead of telling you what we want, it's how to do it. And writing a rule that says you're going to follow those rules doesn't give you any incentive to do it differently. And in fact, we've been writing more and more rules. I have one chart that actually shows the number of pages of regulation, how they keep increasing. And, you know, they've actually added on that chart over 100,000 pages of regulations since about mid-'80s to today.
Bill, did you have anything to add?
And often the appearance of saving money in the short term will increase your cost in the long term. So if you don't develop dual sources up front, which may cost you more, the long-term program costs will be higher. And that's the dilemma we face is that, you know, we focus on the short term and the long-term costs often increase.
A good example of that is when you have to upfront pay for the second source. People say, why do we need a second one when we already have one? You know, in fact, the Great Engine War is an example. Mm-hmm. This was the engines for the F-16, F-15. And the Air Force decided, because they were having trouble with one engine, that they would introduce a second engine. And both engines ended up getting higher performance, higher reliability, and lower costs. The Air Force said they saved over $4 billion on that. But now we come to the F-35 and the Air Force and even the President of the United States and Congress. But the President of the United States said, why do we need a second engine when we already have one? And so they have not allowed a second engine to be – even in this case, the second engine supplier, General Electric in that case, said that they would do the development free. They'd do it under their own overhead. But they still chose not to have competition in that program on the engine, which is the highest maintenance cost of the system. The F-35 is the largest program in history. Wouldn't you want to try to do something that makes sense?
What actions can be taken to improve defense acquisition and the defense industrial base? We will explore these questions and so much more when our special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns.